I'm Spencer Beckwith for KUNM. 150 craftspeople from around the world will have an opportunity this month to show their work in a sort of microcosm of the global marketplace. They've been selected from hundreds of applicants to be part of Santa Fe's annual International Folk Art Market. How can this opportunity then translate into ongoing success for these artists, many of whom live in developing countries? With me is Keith Recker, board member of the nonprofit organization behind the Folk Art Market. Keith, welcome.
Thank you so much.
What are the obstacles that these artists might face in becoming self-sustaining or in thriving as artists?
Well, I think you would begin imagining yourself in the shoes of one of these artists, say, living in Niger, making Tuareg silver jewelry. And there are dozens of families that have traditionally made Tuareg silver jewelry. And the demand for Tuareg silver jewelry among the Tuareg themselves is at best stagnant. And so as the number of people who learn how to make this craft enter the productive phase of their careers, they simply have to find new markets in order to continue to grow and feed their families and embrace the opportunities that life might present them. And one of the best ways for them to do that is to find an opportunity to enter an export market, a foreign market. And the International Folk Art Market has been a springboard for, after this market is complete, we will have served over 1,000 artists over the 15 years of our history. And just coming to Santa Fe and having often the very first trip outside the country, if not also the community, there's a lot of learning about what's going on out there in the world with other forms of jewelry, with pricing, with what customers look at, what American customers want. There are often very productive exchanges between customers and the artists and in and amongst themselves.
So market organization has established several programs to specifically train these artists.
Indeed. In the Mentor to Market program that unfolds every year just before the International Folk Art Market, there are 2 days of training. And the first day is only for artists who are new to the market. How to greet, how to say hello. There's also a discussion about pricing. Pricing is very important. Also, how to tell your story. Most people don't speak English, but a good number of people do speak English who come to the market to show. And running through how to tell your story quickly and cleanly, but with enough information that someone gives you the credibility and authority that you need to close a sale. That's really a skill. So the first day is for new people. And the second day is led mostly by artists. Last year we had 15 artists, experienced artists, do seminars, do workshops, do talks about various topics that are important for success. So while you might come to the market as an expert Zapotec natural dyer, you might have a good deal to learn from somebody coming from Southeast Asia who has a few different tricks to produce a few different gradations of color. So there was actually a workshop where three very experienced, very expert natural dyers were marveling at the subtle differences in their techniques. The temperature at which the red comes up through the indigo so that you get one of those dark, glistening, purpley indigo colors as opposed to just staying down in the navy range. Really interesting information.
And you do also invite industry experts to come in and talk more about business aspects.
That's true. Yes, there's often discussion of intellectual property, and that can be as lofty as discussing companies borrowing or being inspired by the motifs in your work, or as mundane as someone coming through with a very high-grade camera taking altogether too careful pictures of your work. So it's really good, I think, for people to start to have a sense that their work matters and that they have every right to defend themselves and to take up this as a matter of business, as a matter of principle.
Do you find, Keith, that many of these craftspeople have an understanding of how to turn what they do into a business?
I would say that even 75%. By the time they're prepared enough to pass through the jury system and appear at the International Folk Art Market, they're very savvy. It might be street smart, it might be book smart, but they're ready to step into a well-formed marketplace and do what they need to do.
Can we assume, Keith, that most of the artists who come have already self-sustaining careers in what they do?
The majority, yes.
Okay.
Because I think there's an aspect of folk art excellence that the folk art market really insists on. So the first jury, the first of the two juries that the artist must pass through, is made up of museum curators and very experienced gallerists from around the United States. And their job is to ascertain whether what's being shown in the application is the finest example of that tradition being made at this time. The second group is the placement committee. I serve on the placement committee. And the placement committee takes what the selection committee has passed through and looks to form a market that has a balance of geography, a balance of creative medium, so that everything's not jewelry, everything's not textiles, and a balance of look and price point.
Is it possible, Keith, to train for a success in the global marketplace and still retain those traditions that make these arts so appealing to customers?
It's a very good question. And I would say that the answer is yes, increasingly yes. The marketplace in the United States, the marketplace in Europe, is increasingly searching for authenticity and positive effect with discretionary purchases. And that's one of the reasons that we do focus on storytelling. I learned this from my grandfather, or I learned this from the people in my village. It represents this about my culture. Purchasing it does this good, because a lot of the artists are sequestering part of their profits to pay for radio equipment that was damaged in a hurricane because it's a safety issue for the community, or clean wells. There's a group out of India called the She Foundation, beautiful Kantha embroidery technique from Bengal. They are installing toilets in the homes of the embroiderers because a woman is never more vulnerable than when she has to go out into the fields to take care of her business. And this problem can be made to go away by indoor toiletry, and they're working on it. So wow. Artists and the organizations that come to the market have these stories to tell. Cultural authenticity, fantastically positive impact as a result of the purchase, and even permanent change in people's lives.
What advantage is it to the folk art market to provide this training for the artists? How do you benefit from it?
Well, first, we benefit because it's part of our mission. We work with and for artists from all over the world to create economic opportunities and social impact. To give the tools to succeed is why we're there. So it's integral to everything that we do.
What kind of impact have you seen personally, Keith, either here or abroad when you travel to some of these home countries, of the training on these artists and their communities?
I can give you an example of a week that I spent with a group of women from Guatemala, Mayan women living in the highlands of Guatemala, who make hooked rugs using recycled fabrics, mostly U.S. excess clothing, U.S. t-shirts that get shipped down in bales to Guatemala. And these ladies don't necessarily have a rug tradition in their craft lexicon, but they do have the most amazing textile tradition of embroidering and weaving amazing motifs in their blouses called huipil. Every village has its own huipil. Styles change across the cycle of years so that birds become bigger or smaller, flowers become fuchsia rather than emerald. Right now we're in a very heavy turquoise and pink phase in certain communities. They adapt this amazing vocabulary of embellishment into the designs that they create for their rugs. I've heard stories about the increased income changing lives along these lines. When a woman is able to bring her own income into the home, the esteem with which she's held by her husband changes. She's now a partner in the business of having a family, and she gets treated more and more often as a partner in the business of sustaining that family. We've heard stories of husbands and mothers-in-law having fits, that these women would go to training sessions to learn how to make rugs, that they go to training sessions to do design. What a waste of time. What a horrible, disturbing thing to see you get on that bus. And yet when the income comes in, all of a sudden, workshops are being built in back of the house. Shelving units are being built so that all the materials can stay clean and dry. Husbands start to get into preparing the t-shirt yarn that is made into the rugs. And people start to work together. better medical care for children, better nutrition, being able to afford school uniforms and tuition fees. People's health is better. People's self-respect is better. It's an overall lift just with the simple addition of women's income.
Even here in America, people who choose a career in the arts or in crafts encounter a lot of obstacles. Why are the obstacles different in some of the countries that your artists represent?
Access to finance is a big obstacle in countries in Africa, Asia, and Latin America, particularly if you're in a small, small business. Having the capital to buy material to come to a big market like Santa Fe can be an obstacle for some people. Having the capital to buy some basic tools and equipment can be an obstacle for some people. Depending on where someone lives, having a market could be a big obstacle. So if you live in Oaxaca, where there is a thriving tourist trade, you have maybe a little bit less to worry about in terms of having a customer base coming to you. If you don't have that, you might end up needing to travel for hours by bus to get to a town market. And can you do that every day? Or can you only do that once a month or once a week? And how is it that you have the product to be sure that that trip is going to make it worth your while? So there's an access issue in addition to a finance issue. One of the hopes that we have is that everybody who comes to the market succeeds in terms of achieving a healthy sales goal. And between 80 and 90% of that income goes home with the artist. And you know, well managed, that can be a nest egg with which to address some of these needs for finance. The reputation of people who go to the market, it's a feather in their cap. And so we hope that that helps them sort of put their shoulders back and tell that story there in the place where they're from. And also, we do increasingly see that people showing at the market start to make connections with other companies. We have some very interesting wholesalers and retailers come to the market, and they often strike up very loving and supportive and multi-year relationships with some of these folks. The market itself also is in the midst of creating an expanded menu of sales opportunities. I think it's 18 artists just finished showing at the Smithsonian Folklife Festival in D.C., and that's new for us. We had a cohort of artists presenting at the Dallas Market Center to a wholesale audience, and results this year were fantastic. So in addition to Santa Fe, which is the mothership, and every artist has to come first through the jurying process and show in Santa Fe so that we can get to know them, then there are often these opportunities that open up in other places in the United States.
What kind of comments do you get or do you hear, Keith, from the artists who come to Santa Fe and take part in that extraordinary assemblage of people on Museum Hill?
One of the artists last year, in the middle of the welcoming ceremony in the plaza, which happens the night before the market opens, leaned to me and said, "You know, this is everything that's right with the world."
Keith Recker is on the board of the nonprofit International Folk Art Market Santa Fe. The 2018 market is July 14th and 15th on Museum Hill. Keith, thank you so much for joining
me. You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
For KUNM, I'm Spencer Beckwith.